Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Here we go. I mean, President-elect Trump has made it very clear that he wants to go after some markets. He wants to hold people accountable. But I think the unspoken part of that, too, is they want to see American businesses prosper. And the way you do that is by opening up these markets for our exports.
Kent Back is Executive Director, Government Affairs, National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
You know, we talk a lot about Buy America, but we also need to talk more about Sell America. And I think there's a lot we can do, especially in the Asian markets and in a lot of the other emerging markets that want high quality U.S. beef. And we got to remove these trade barriers in order to get it to them. So we're excited about what the next year holds. We think there's going to be a lot of opportunities out there. And one thing's for sure, it won't be boring.
This is Agriculture Today.
America's Farms and Ranches at a Glance is an annual report.
Catherine Lim is a research economist with USDA on America's Farms and Ranches.
The 2024 edition uses 2023 data, which is the most recent data USDA has from their ARMS survey. It comes out every year. It looks at the characteristics of U.S. farms and ranches, generally looking at what farms produce, aspects of their financial situation, their participation in federal agricultural programs. In older years, it was the Diverse Family Farms report, but we've been putting out this report for a number of years.
Speaking of farms and ranches, what's the latest barometer say about the ag economy? Dr. Jim Mentored with Purdue.
The Ag Economy Barometer Index declined 9 points this month to a reading of 136, but that left the index still 21 points higher than it was in October. And the decline in the index was mostly attributable to a decline in the current condition index, which fell 13 points compared to last month to a reading of just 100. That leaves that index 5 points higher, however, than it was in October. The future expectation index also declined, but it fell just 8 points compared to last month, and that left that index still 29 points higher than it was in October. The Farm Financial Performance Index dropped back 8 points compared to November, but that was still stronger than it was in October when the reading was 90. The Farm Capital Investment Index declined 7 points compared to a month ago, but that was still 5 points higher than it was a year ago. That reading, of course, this time was 48 versus 43 a year ago. And the primary reason that among folks who say it's a bad time to make large investments has shifted over time. Primary reason they say it's a bad time to make investments is more people are pointing to uncertainty about farm profitability. A year ago, that was roughly 17% of the people in the survey. Here in December of 2024, that was up to 35% of the people who say it's a bad time to make large investments in their farming operation. The short-term farmland value expectation index was lower again this month for the second month in a row, down 5 points to a reading of 110. However, that index is still 15 points higher than it was back in September. We've been asking a series of questions both before and after the election to learn why there was a change in sentiment. The first question was, do you think environmental regulations impacting agriculture will be more restrictive, less restrictive, or about the same 5 years from now? And after the election, it was clear more and more producers said that they look for agriculture to face a more favorable regulatory environment after the election than they expected prior to the election. We also asked about tax rates. And compared to October, more producers in both November and December said they expect income tax rates to be lower in the future than they did back in October. And finally, estate tax rates. Producers also said they expect to see lower estate taxes applied to agriculture than they said that they expected back in October. We also asked for the last 2 months now, how likely do you think U.S. agriculture is at risk of a trade war that results in a significant decrease in U.S. ag exports? In November, 42% of the respondents said they thought a trade war was either likely or very likely. In December, that was up somewhat to 48% of producers who think a trade war is either likely or very likely. And then we did a follow-up question on the December survey. Do you think that following the fall 2024 elections, will that lead to a farm safety net that is stronger than, weaker than, or about the same as expected before the election? And over half of December's survey respondents said that they think the 2024 election will lead to a stronger farm income safety net than was previously in place.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
House Republicans are looking to introduce legislation. They're going to try to prioritize a couple of key things that will be important to the new administration.
Kent Back is Executive Director, Government Affairs, National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
Yeah, a couple of those are going to be border security and taxes. So with the House and the Senate both in, we're looking for a lot of movement in those first 100 days. Keep in mind, we have a national debt that I checked this last night. It looks like we're close to about $36.3 trillion in that national debt. On January 1st, the debt ceiling, that's when the Treasury will start using extraordinary measures. And so with that backdrop in mind, Congress is going to be, they're going to look at budget reconciliation as a vehicle to move these two key policy areas on border security and taxes.
President-elect Trump would like it in one reconciliation bill.
The Congressional Budget Act, it permits using reconciliation for legislation that changes spending, revenues, and or the federal debt limit. On the spending side, reconciliation can be used to address most mandatory or entitlement spending. So in that budget process at the beginning of the year, Congress will most likely include these reconciliation directives. So with that, they will include instructions or directions to committees to make changes to specific laws within their jurisdiction in order to meet those budget targets and therefore reconcile the budget. So that's what that budget reconciliation goes through. The interesting thing about budget reconciliation, in the House, you just need a simple majority like all things. And so with that tight margin in the House, Republicans still should be able to move some of these key initiatives rather quickly. On the Senate side, the interesting part about budget reconciliation is that the filibuster is not allowed. So the compromise to that is something called the Byrd Rule after former Senator Robert Byrd. In that case, amendments are limited in scope and in number. And so that means that you can't have as many of these adjacent policies. So if they're going to focus on border security, there's some key things that they'll have to stay within and some guidelines. And with the tax package, especially if they're looking at the revenue side, then that means that they're going to be able to focus on a lot of these key things.
So at this point, what's the biggest question?
So this is my Schoolhouse Rock timeline that I like to put out there, but the stick figures are not meant to undermine the seriousness, but there is a lot of back and forth and messaging you're going to hear throughout the year. But if this is the vehicle that they choose to use with budget reconciliation, that means that that they're going to have some rules that they have to stay within. So we know that House Republicans have been working for the last few months with their tax teams to be able to put something together. We know that that Senate Republicans have also been looking at what their priorities are going to be. But with those tight margins in the House and the Senate, you are going to have some kind of bipartisan package that comes together. So that's the big question is, are they going to update the tax code? Are they just going to extend it? Will we potentially see a default if all these efforts fail? I think it's unlikely that the efforts have failed, but the aggressive timeline that's been proposed is always subject to the minutia and the swamp nature of Washington. So that tends to slow things down. But the big priorities are going to be, death tax, 199A, bonus depreciation, and some of the other things that Tia had just mentioned. So as we look at all this, that's going to be the big question.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
This one has done successfully. His kids are all in it. They actually homeschooled them. I don't think they would mind me sharing with them. And they are all 18 years or less.
Speaking last month at the 2024 Midwest Ag Conference in Chicago, Matt Karstens, president and CEO of Landus, on the future of the family farm.
The last one's just finishing up school, and we'll be joining the farm. That's how they did it. Right. I mean, it's their farm. It's that one family. It's not like our family farm is multiple families with the same last name. Theirs is one family, one name. And what will happen with their kids when they have other, I don't know. It's a challenge without a doubt. I think there's been a lot of good progress with insurance policies and that made on transitioning family farms, like is what our family operation is doing. So insurance makes it possible. There's a lot of complexities to that. But there's getting to be better ways and more known ways to do it. So I don't think the family farm's dead by any means. But, you know, also a big land buyer in Iowa is called the Delta Group. Look that up. That's one individual in the Delta that's buying a lot of land. I never met the man. I don't have any issue with it. But to your question, how do we feel about it? I don't know. You know, this is all, I'm giving you data that's no more than 3 years old, right? And this is happening right in front of us. So to the tension that we all have, we need answers on this. And I share, you know, I will slam my fist down and in this topic spirit of we should have answers to this instead of vague shades of gray of what I see, what you see, what you see. That's just not right. And we deserve better. The agriculture sector deserves better.
But one big issue on family farms and the future is consolidation.
Our family is a big independent hog producer in Iowa. And by big, it ain't that big. There's 18 left in Iowa that are independent hog producers. When I was growing up, that was probably 3,500 to 4,000. And today we've got 18. Now, I don't stand or sit in front of you and in front of this beautiful fire we have and say, I think that's going to happen on the land side, but it's going to be a pretty dramatic change. Our largest farmer in Iowa, when he came to my office, now probably just short of 2 years ago, was 35,000 acres. Today, he's over 60. Now, that's a family-ran business. Purest definition of family farm. His boys are all involved. His wife's involved. Then they employ a bunch of people. But it's coming. Do I like it? You know, on one hand, obviously no. But on the other hand, you know, we can't find workers. You know, it's just getting harder and harder by the day. You know, so is 60,000 in a state like Iowa or Illinois in your district, is that right? That's probably high. But I think there's two on his heels that also do a good chunk of business with us, three or four more behind them. And I would just caution you all to open your eyes. I don't think it'll be as fast as what we saw on the livestock side, but it's coming and we're watching it and we just can't see it. I mean, the numbers are staggering. Are those top 10 farmers of Landis where they were 2 years ago, where they are today, blows your mind. And I think that's going to continue. You know, the thing we should fear is we got to make sure it's not foreign ownership. Right. And that I think our governments, state and federal, are doing a better job of acknowledging. But I think we still have a long ways to go there. One of the biggest landowners, and this isn't a religious statement, it's just a fact. One of the biggest landowners we have in the Midwest is the Mormon Church. And, you know, is that good or bad? I don't know. You know, I just know it's happening. And we've got to open our eyes.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Last month, we kind of made a little bit of a point of the fact that the index got above 50 because it's been kind of a trading range of about 30 to 50 for really the better part of 3 years.
Referencing the Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer, Dr. Jim Mentert and Dr. Michael Langemeyer with the Center for Commercial Ag.
We're below 50, but not by much. And what do you make of that?
I think the index of future expectations is driving this higher than it was in September and October. I mean, look at the chart here. We're 15 to 20 points higher than we were in September and October. And so I point back to the strength of that five-year index.
Yeah, good point. So we ask people every month what their plans are for farm machinery purchases in the upcoming year compared to a year ago. And this goes to everybody in the survey. From September through November, fewer people were starting to tell us that they were going to pull back on their farm machinery purchases. This month, that bounced back to the upside a little bit. So 56% of the people in the survey this month said they were going to have lower farm machinery purchases in the upcoming year. That's compared to 51% last month. 55% in October and 69% in September. So we're kind of seeing a little bit of a shift here. For a while there, fewer people were telling us they're going to cut back on farm machinery. Now we're kind of edging back up. Is there a little more realism getting back in this?
I think so. And again, I'll point to the drop in the index of current conditions. There's a little bit of a drop there, and that's consistent with an increase. Increase in those that think there's going to be lower purchases.
Yeah, and the shift is pretty consistent here with respect to where it's going. It's basically bouncing between people who say they're going to hold their machinery purchases about the same on a year-to-year basis versus pulling back on them, the percentage of people tell us they plan to increase their purchases, pretty consistent. It's always a small number. This month it was 8%. It's been as low as 5%, and that was back in September. So we basically bounced in that 5 to 8% range of saying I'm going to increase my purchases. So the change is always going to be pretty consistently over long periods of time between people saying about the same and pulling back. So for people who tell us it's a bad time to make large investments, we followed up and asked, why do you feel that way? And one of the things that's striking, Michael, is the fact that the percentage of people who say it's because of the uncertainty about farm profitability has really shifted over the last roughly 12 months. You go back to the beginning of this year, 17% of the people in the survey who think it's a bad time to make an investment said it was because of uncertainty about farm profitability. That's virtually doubled. It's at 35% here in December.
This is a really curious result because it's a little inconsistent with some of the other results we're going to talk about. I mean, yeah, as you said, there's a large increase in the uncertainty about farm profitability. You could point to a lot of uncertainty related to prices, where prices are heading. And so that's certainly possible there. But we also asked a question about safety net, which we're going to get to here. And they actually think the safety net's going to be stronger after the 24 election. So I think that's a little bit inconsistent with the way they're answering this chart. Am I reading too much into that?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure I agree with you on that one, Michael, because uncertainty about farm profitability could be driven strictly by what's taking place in the marketplace.
And so not so much downside, but just volatility.
Well, and so you might expect the weakness in farm profitability to be offset by government payments, which I think is what we're picking up in the other question.
Yeah, you're probably right. That's probably what
we're thinking. We'll talk about that in a minute when we get to that chart.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Gearing up for this year, one of the things we wanted to do was take a survey of cattle producers across the country. For us as an industry, we have to ask those questions directly because we want to make sure that we're able to tell our side of the story and be able to relate that message directly.
It was a tax survey, according to Kent Backus, Executive Director, Government Affairs, National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
So we conducted this survey. Had over 1,200 responses, and this was not just a simple "do you like taxes or not" survey. This was very detailed, 35 questions going through parts of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and other key provisions that are out there, and asking about those specific impacts. 99% of the survey respondents identify as a family-owned enterprise, and I think that's an important thing that we in agriculture have to do is to continue to put that face, that human element on the letters and numbers of a very complex tax code. But a couple of the things that we found is when you look at the death tax specifically, a third of our respondents have already had to pay the death tax once. And from that number, another 35% have had to pay it more than once. And that's just that's really bad. And when you look at the significance of farm and ranch operations, many times we are asset rich and cash poor. And I know that's a phrase that is. That's been used many times, but it is true. Our greatest value, many times our greatest asset, is the land. And in order to pay a tax bill at the time of death, by the way, on land and a business that's paid taxes many, many times throughout its life, many times people have to either take out a massive loan or they have to sell off part of that operation. So you're not just selling land. You're selling part of a business. You're selling part of a family venture. And that is something that we hope to avoid. But if we do see the death tax limits revert back to those pre-2017 levels, then that's going to affect about 61% of our survey respondents. And that is not something that we take lightly. So this will be a priority for us moving forward. As far as the 199A qualified business income deduction, with that being relatively new, we still had over half of the respondents who have used it, and they've considered it a very important tool. So I think that's something that we want to see continue in the next package. And when you look at 179 and bonus depreciation, one of the key things we ask is, if these tools weren't available, how would that impact you? And what we found is that in both cases, with both of those tools, that not having access to it, that about 25 to 30% of the respondents would have had to pay an additional $20,000 in taxes. So that's pretty significant when you look at these key tools. So there's a lot of key things that we're looking to advance in this next Congress. And keep in mind, when you look at Congress, most of the people that are going to be making these decisions were not here the last time Congress had to take up these complex tax policies. So not just the members of Congress, but also their staff. The staff turnover has been significant, and that's not something that we take lightly either. So as part of those advocacy efforts, we're not only working just within CBA and through our state affiliates across 44 states and with our breed affiliates, we're also working with Tax Aggies. We're working with Family Business Estate Tax Coalition, working with a lot of other Main Street interests that represent those small family businesses. And so I think that if that's something that you're interested in and you want to get engaged, then I strongly encourage you to do so. We're going to move fast and furious on this, because with this first 100-day timeline, that means that we're going to have to be on the ground and engaging directly. So it's important for you to be part of that process and help educate these members of Congress and their staff.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
If you think you can pull up a report that says China owns this much, you're absolutely crazy.
Matt Karstens is president and CEO of Landa, speaking last month at the 2024 Midwest Agriculture Conference.
I'll give you a personal story. I used to have a home in a rural area that was on a lake, and a guy bought the house two doors down, and ironically paid cash. And the deal actually fell through, even though he paid cash. But I went over and introduced myself as he was there looking. And I go, what do you do? And he goes, I buy land for China, Chinese companies. I'm like, what? I thought that was illegal. Like, I think we couldn't do that in the state. So then I started doing my own research and finding, you know, they're like, well, look at this, and this ties to this, and this ties to that. It's not as black and white. I do not know the percentage. That I cannot tell you. But I know it's bigger than we think, and we know, and I know it's an issue because our government is talking about it very aggressively, and particularly the senators from Iowa with Ernst and Grassley have been really good champions, and I'm proud of them for standing up and getting to the bottom of whatever's going on here. I don't perceive to be the expert. Something's going on. We've got to figure this thing out. And if it's 1% or 5 or 10, I don't care. That, to me, all of those numbers seems like too many. I mean, think about that. I mean, ag is how we feed and fuel the world and clothe it, by the way, mostly in this country. I acknowledge there's other good countries, too, but this one's pretty darn good at it. And here's this thing that you go, not a problem. I go, I'm not sure, but it's a bigger problem. How do we not know this answer? This is the United States of America. And we're sitting there going, I'm not sure what the answer is. So do your own research. Come up with your own deductive reasonings. I assure you there's a challenge here. Don't take my word for it, though. Follow some of the work that the government is doing on it and do some on your own. And I think you'll find some interesting twists and turns there. Relative to the family farms, I don't think the family farm is going to die. That 60,000 acre farmer is absolutely a family farm. What will go down is the number of family farms, without a doubt. A lot of them are struggling to get the next generation to come home and farm. I mean, a lot of them come and work for Landis. Or the feds, or, you know, they went to college and they want to do something beyond being a farmer. I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just saying the number is clearly going down, and we've got to do something to make sure those keep coming back and we protect what we can of the family farm. But the number of family farms, without a doubt, are falling and falling at a pretty steady rate. Again, is that right or wrong? I don't know.
And the bottom line is, how do you transition with these kind of numbers?
Look at what Iowa, I'm just going to pick on Iowa here. Iowa farmland, you know, what are we at? 12, 13,000 an acre, and some of the land's going for $22,000 to $28,000 an acre. How do you transition that? I mean, that's real cash. Like, no bank's going to take that risk. So you end up with these big pocketbooks, whether it's other countries, other buyers. You know, I get it. Our role is, and what I'm telling you, I guess to be really transparent with you, what we're doing is, we're finding a way to connect our farmers to those buyers, because I don't have a solution for the transition, although there are some. So you look at the massive movement of an Iowa, an Illinois, an eastern Nebraska, northern Missouri, southern Minnesota, and on. How do you transition that when farmland's what it is? When the ups and downs of a market, where you've got China, who used to buy our biggest buyer by a mile, exiting the market. These are real challenges. So I love talking about tech because it's positive. Like, and there's a path there, but these are other things that literally keep me up at night.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Regarding the U.S. agricultural trade balance in 2024,
our expectation is for a record trade deficit
due to several factors, according to USDA Chief Economist Seth Meyer, such as a strong U.S. dollar overseas, increased global competition for primary U.S. farm commodities, and
with that strong dollar, U.S. consumers continue to import products to diversify their diets as well, too.
The chief economist also notes some of the global market challenges for our nation's food and farm exports going into 2025.
Policy being one of them, things that we always talk about, size of the South American crop, but other things as well. We've still got an active conflict in the Black Sea, other geopolitical tensions, all of which could affect the market in the coming year.
A first indication of competition developing in the new year comes from January's World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate and production estimates from corn and beans in Argentina and Brazil. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.